Hello, everyone. This is Anastasia with Gazelli Art House, and welcome to our Twitter space with the artist Andreas Gissen. Andreas, can you hear me okay?
Hello, hello. Does it work?
Yes, it does indeed. Perfect. Well, welcome. It's a pleasure to have you here and to host you. For those who are just joining us now, Andreas has been part of the Gazelio residency in the month of November and has been sharing some of his amazing works with us. And just to quickly introduce him, he is an artist based in Lugano, Switzerland. And he's a very much a research-based artist, and his artwork revolves around experimentation, analysis, and discovery, and the fundamental process of both artistic and commercial projects. And today, we will hopefully learn even more about his practice. So I'm extremely excited to be speaking with you, Andreas.
Hey, thank you. Thank you for having me.
I don't know if you want to say a few words about yourself, if there's anything that I have missed, or anything that's on your mind, just to kind of kick this off. If not, I'm also happy to delve straight into the questions, but I thought we would keep it quite casual and comfortable.
I think you said already too much. I guess every artist bases his own practice around research. And yeah, the same it values for me as well.
Amazing. That's great to hear. So actually, I mean that kind of maybe I thought we would start by, for those who don't know your work, maybe we could start from the very beginning. And so my first question is, what attracted you to kind of code-based and generative art?
I'm a designer by trade, and I started to work with computers very early in the late 80s, I would say. And so I was attracted to it, to games, because I was a kid, but also I discovered that it was possible to program these machines. And this interest eventually brought me to a certain type of study, and it drove me to study engineering, but I discovered that I wasn't a great fit for it. Despite having a father that was a mathematician, I was quite bad in mathematics. And so I had to give up my engineering career. And so I pivoted somehow to graphic design, which I felt very close to what I was doing already. And also computers started to appear heavily in this industry, so I thought, okay, this could be an interesting direction for my eventual future work. And during my design days and my design career, I mixed this passion and this powerful tool that I was exploring. I mixed it into my practice and into my work as a designer. And so it came naturally to use these systems or computational approach for my designs. And eventually, the more experimental side of my work, I would say work that was not client-based or more personal, eventually took off on a life on itself. And so here we are.
That's fantastic. Actually, it's very interesting because what I have been noticing in the past few years that there is actually a lot of artists that have actually been transitioning from this design background, and it's only kind of in recent years that their artistic practice had the possibility to kind of take independent flight outside of kind of working for specific clients with specific demands. So it's very curious that you kind of you come from that background as well. And I was kind of I wanted to take it in a slightly different direction. So from what I can see, you were always kind of a creative thinker. In this case, kind of graphic design also requires a lot of creative thinking. Are there any specific tools or techniques that are integral to your workflow at the moment, and that may be were inspiration an inspiration to you in the early days?
But first of all, I think I'm Swiss, so if I studied Swiss graphic designers from the past, and it was so this Kunstgewerbe, this German word, it's art and work somehow in one single word, as the Germans often do. Many of these pioneers of these practitioners that inspired me, they had these two sides. They were artists, they were designers, they were architects, they were many things. And so it wasn't even such a strong division between these two practices. They were image makers somehow, and some of these experiments, they were standalone, and some other experiments became client-based work and were very suited for communication. So I think I follow somehow this kind of steps in a certain way. And about the tools that I use, there are many. I think I use code in a way that it's meaningful to me, and it's a very quick tool, let's say, to generate images that I wouldn't be able to make otherwise. So I don't know if I have a specific tool. I have some instruments in place, but they tend to vary or to change or to evolve over time. But I would say the main tool, if you want, is probably code in the latest practice.
That's fantastic. And actually, it's very interesting to me how c code can be used in so many diverse ways. And one of the things that I was very curious about, because your work is so multifaceted as well, how much control do you retain over kind of the final artistic output? Because you've done some very extensive custom coding, and I know that you've done some custom hardware as well for your projects. So yeah, I was very curious to hear kind of from your artistic perspective, how much of it is control versus chance?
Control is total, I would say. I don't leave much to change, to chance. I think that come also from my job, where my purpose as a designer, especially, or for every designer, I would say, is maximum clarity. So everything needs to be clear, and even the intent needs to be clear somehow. And I think I work in the same way when I work for myself. And I mean, there are means to play with chance, especially with code somehow, and that's also an interesting chapter. But even in this situation, chance is controlled. There is space for some surprise, obviously, and experimentation means being able to be surprised at a certain point. But I think I hope, or I like to say to myself that everything is under control.
That's absolutely lovely. And do you think you might delve into this kind of experimentation with chance in the future? Or is this something you're not very interested in?
But I would like to, for example, to be a great dancer, and so where I could completely let myself go in the unknown, but it's not really my thing, I guess. So
Fair enough, fair enough. And one of the things that I've noticed is that your art kind of seamlessly blends artistic expression and technological innovation. Is there a particular way that you maintain balance between the aesthetic and the technical aspects in your work?
I try. I don't want to really to use this word, but for the moment, I don't have a better one. I try some sort of holistic approach, if you want. So I like that the code, the hardware, and the piece itself is executed at the maximum of my capacity, of my knowledge. So I try to make it as good as I can. And I think the form that emerges from this kind of approach is basically a consequence of this kind of working. So Yeah, don't know if this is clear. Maybe it's not so clear even for myself, but.
Well, it does sound very conceptual, but I think for a very necessary reason. And so obviously, to me, from what I can see, like hardware plays a very important role in your art. And I know that for a lot of kind of code-based and generative artists, this isn't the case. So is there a reason why you lean towards displays of a specific type? Because I know you have worked with everything kind of from like almost like signage that is used in advertisement to like very old school kind of flip apparatuses. So yeah.
But first of all, hardware is hard, and sorry for this wordplay, but it's really difficult for several reasons. So first of all, it's a physical thing that you need to drag along. You need a space for this. You need documentation. It's also expensive, so it creates a certain type of environment, and it needs a lot of knowledge. And most of this knowledge I don't have personally. It's also by choice. I stopped at a certain level in hardware design. So I work with engineers. I understand enough of it to be able to drive and to express exactly what I need and what I want. But then I really enjoy the discussion with the pros or with the experts in this field. And then the things get built with them. And about the signage and the old stuff and the displays, this is an approach. It's really a big part of my work, and also my work with CD, my partner, is to take one of these pieces or some device as an entry point for something. So we don't work well with absolute freedom. So we choose something, we choose a playground, we choose something with a lot of limitations, and then we start to work with this piece. And hardware is a optimal situation for this, because hardware is limited in size, in possibilities, in color, in speed, and things like this. So contrary to a computer screen, where you can display anything from text to a movie to a static image to an animation, some of these older devices, they have such a limited scope, such limited possibilities. And this is for me a very interesting point to start to reason about it. So what can you do with this thing? What was it meant to do? A display. It was meant to display information. It was meant to show. It was a timetable, for example. So it was meant to show time. So what else can you do with this kind of device? How much can you push it to its limit to find something else in it? And I think this is really a central part of how I work, and or how we work, again with the engineers and also with my partner.
That's absolutely fascinating. I think a lot of interest, especially for us being kind of both a digital and a physical gallery, is in displaying these parts of physical projects as well and physical experimentations. And I was actually curious, I mean, hearing you speak about the different types of hardware that you use, what has been your favorite project? And maybe there's something that you would like to highlight to our audiences today who are maybe not familiar with your work.
But the favorite project is always the next one. I don't like to go back to past projects. Somehow I feel almost a certain kind of disgust. So I don't like them anymore. Or I look at them in a different way. So the past projects I somehow leave them in the past. But some of the past projects, I also feel that they are not explored enough. So as long as they keep in this state of unfinishedness, can you say this in English? I don't know. Of incompleteness, let's say, then I always think, okay, maybe there is something that you can squeeze out of this even more, or you can go even deeper into this one. So, but even in this case, it's not the same old project. It's an old project that you try to observe under a different angle. And another point of going harder, of going physical, is that we weren't really able to sell our work based on software in the past 20 years, I would say. So it was really hard to try to push something to a eventual collector that wasn't tangible. And so we often, it was a sort of a trick. So we also build a body around a certain piece of software so that it becomes physical, so that it becomes something concrete, also limited in a certain way. You make one, two, or three copies of this object, and that's enough. And then at least maybe you can interest a few collectors with this. And it wasn't very successful, to be honest.
I think there's definitely an interest, and it's something that we get asked all the time, is how do you display the work and whether you can or can't live with it on a daily basis? And my answer is there's always a way. if you really like the work, you can kind of, you can find a way to display it in your home. I also wanted to maybe ask you to speak a little bit on this idea of screen as canvas, because it's something that you have mentioned in the past, and whether it was kind of a challenge for your work to exist in both the physical and the digital realm. And are there any challenges that you still face as an artist in that sense? Or has the process been so much streamlined with kind of the new technologies and also the blockchain technologies that is much easier to combine the two?
Yeah, but this is also a point that interests me somehow, because at a certain point, if you have a physical piece, you don't need anything else. You don't need a digital contract, you don't need a software counterpart, because the physical piece is it. You don't need a certificate of authenticity for a piece that exists in the physical world, because the piece itself is certificate enough and its existence is proof of it. So, but in certain situations, I wanted to profit a little bit from a new audience, from a new user base, for a new eventual potential collectors around the globe. And so I found myself in the situation to combine these two worlds, so the physical and, in some case, a digital or a software-only counterpart that somehow becomes a sort of companion of this hardware piece. And yeah, it's something I still think about, and it's not only my problem. I see many artists that, for example, sell plots, no, something which is made from a plotter, and they sell it through to their audience that collects things on the blockchain or in the form of NFTs. And so this, the relationship between the digital part, the token, and the physical piece, I think this is an interesting chapter, and it has many ways to be solved as well.
Yeah, I completely agree. And actually, I mean, on that subject, one of your projects recently celebrated its anniversary, the LCD1, which was submitted as part of the Lumen Prize. So I wanted to see kind of, because obviously it's a project that basically was both a physical living object and an ERC token. And so I wanted to see kind of a year after, what is the response of the collectors, and kind of how has been the life for the project since its first launch?
Well, this was an experiment, first of all. And that's one exactly specifically for this project, I ask myself this question. So I have now this piece in its physical form. It's finished. There is this custom software that runs on it. I'm able even to make each hardware piece unique in a physical way by signing it in the hardware in a way that it cannot be altered in the future. So you kind of inscribe a string or addition number or something else directly into the hardware. And but I wanted to try this mechanism of a NFT sale with an auction and everything. And so the question was, how do I combine these two things? And for this project, the answer was to create a piece of software that is linked to the token, not directly on the blockchain, but in the form of metadata, but still. And this piece of software, I wanted to make it in a way that it is not able to run on its own. So the idea was that the software of the token functions or works only when it's physically connected to the device. So these two things are not really two, but they are more or less one, the extension of the other. And I don't know if this idea passed or if it was communicated clearly in general, but still. And just to give you some numbers, the physical piece was made in 32 pieces, 32 physical objects, and plus a few artist proofs. And the same number of tokens was sold in this auction. And I was really happy because the response was great. The collector, they jumped on it and they bought everything. And so I said, okay, I managed to sell these tokens. And now the collectors will reach out and finally, through the token, get the physical device. But after 1 year, only half of the devices have been claimed, and so by the collectors. And so half of these devices, they still sit in my studio, and half of the tokens, they sit in some wallet of some collector without any purpose, because without the physical device, you cannot even display anything. It just, you just get a gray rectangle with some information on it, and that's it. So I learned something from this experience. And I think, yeah, so this is the experience so far.
That's actually very interesting. I mean, obviously, in terms of the project, it's interesting to see the response. And I mean, it takes me back to this idea of a lot of collectors, especially in the Web3 space, trying to be anonymous and not necessarily even wanting a physical object. But in this case, I think they're definitely missing out, and hopefully maybe there are some of them listening to us today. So guys, please contact the artist, get the counterpart. We need to make sure that this work has a life. Oh, that's fantastic. Taking a slightly different angle, I wanted to kind of, maybe you would like to comment on the fact about kind of geometry in your work. Obviously, some of it comes organically from the hardware as well, but whether this is something that has always been in your practice or it appeared at a certain point.
No, I think it was a central part of my work in general, because how I define geometry, maybe it's not a correct definition, but it's a very close relationship between numbers and form. So in a certain way, and of course this is the computer or the machine is a perfect match for these two things, because the computer understands number very well. And if you are able to express a shape or express movement or express color through numbers, then you are in a good place. And the machine is a perfect tool to translate numbers into actual forms in the on the display. But I think with this kind of view, in a little bit of in a broader way, if you look at the world through these eyes, then you see, you can define geometry in many other things. You can define music as a sort of geometry, because again, a melody and chords is a relationship between notes, and notes exist on a scale, and the scale can also be expressed as numbers, and even the frequency themselves. And so, yeah, I think geometry is really an integral part of my work since very long, and I think even before I actively or consciously thought about this sort of definition.
That's fantastic. And have you in the past experimented with combining, for example, music and let's say numbers in this sense?
But I studied piano and then clarinet, and also wanted to play the drums. But I think my sense, my way to a bit like the dance that I mentioned before, when I try to express in real time my own rhythm, the result is a complete failure. So I try to find ways to codify the rhythm, and so that it's not me that it's going to express, so it's more the, in this case, a machine that it's taking this idea. But I brought a lot of music in the past through methods which are very close to this discussion of geometry I mentioned before. So one thing was where these mods, which were famous on the Amiga computer that I never had. But basically, you would input notes as numbers almost, and you could then create sequences of these notes. And these sequences, again, you could number them, and then you could choose which sequence play and which sequence next. And then after, I experimented a lot with sound synthesis and systems to generate scales and chords, but completely based on numerical rules. And yeah, I was not very successful, and I was never convinced by my own results. So that's probably, I think I probably wanted to be a musician or some sort of a dancer, but I failed completely. And so I think the visual output is some sort of a fallback of my failed career.
I think there's still definitely potential to combine, and there's always a lot of artists that I speak with find beauty in imperfection. There are sometimes these occurrences where and you think that it's a failure, but then somebody comes around and they look at it and actually they find something so special in it that it becomes their favorite piece. So I would definitely say to continue experimenting because I think it would be absolutely fascinating.
But as I leave the hardware design to engineers, I also leave the music to musicians and to people that know their craft very well. And I collaborated very often with people that do music. So that's my way to get back into this world somehow.
And how do these collaborations enhance or challenge your creative process? Like, do they have an impact on your artistic perspective, or is it mainly kind of through a specific vision, a specific lens that you approach a project?
But if you are talking again about music, there is a problem, let's say, for visual artists, or because the music comes first. So when I work on musical projects, I come in a second moment. So the music is there already, and then I start to work with it, or let's say on it. And then it's like it's a bit more, it's not direct. There is no interaction between me and the musicians in a way that I'm able to also transform the musical output. But I'm completely okay with it. I also don't want to really tell the musicians what they have to do or something. So I really this initial part of the music that has been created is something that is not mutable anymore. But yeah, maybe eventually this could also change. I can imagine a different approach, but it never happened until now, so I don't know.
Definitely. And in terms of your other collaborations, because you've worked collaboratively with a number of some fantastic artists, how did these come about?
Why do you say that? I don't collaborate much with other artists. I collaborate a lot with my historical partner, let's say, because we kind of grew together in this work. But now I'm on a new venture with two friends, and which are Kim and Leander. I see them. Hi, Kim. Hi, Leander. Thank you for listening. I hope I'm doing well. You will tell me later. And so there is a new collaboration around the edge. So it's Kim Asendorf and Leander Herzog. And so this is also new for me to collaborate with different artists with a different view, and to see how this goes. I think personally, I'm not really good on collaborating with people that are too aligned with me somehow, or that are too close on what I do. But I think that this might actually work. So I'm looking forward to this new collaboration.
We're also very much looking forward to seeing what comes out of this partnership. Amazing. And kind of another question, kind of delving back into this idea of audiences. And do you rely a lot on audience engagement in your work, and whether interpretation, a specific interpretation of your work is important to you, or whether you kind of leave it up to each viewer's outlook?
But as I mentioned before, my goal is absolute clarity, which is of course an illusion, because many people or some people come back with the feedback, and of course apparently it wasn't clear enough, because what they tell me is something completely different from what I imagined. So it's probably not so I'm not so clear as I hope to be. But so most of the time, I don't like the feedback they give me. So I prefer to not have any feedback at all. And I think the worst kind of feedback that I can get, and I usually get this from very close friends or from people that are close to me, is when they send me a work from some other artist or for something they saw around. And they think, and it's a work that is somehow close, formally at least, to my practice. And they think that because it's close of what I do, that I might like it. And it's very often the case that I really don't like it. And this is for me the worst experience, because in this moment, I feel that I'm not really understood. So
That's absolutely fair enough. I think it's actually very interesting, because I mean, you mentioned that even when you work on projects, you don't like when people are specifically aligned, so maybe it comes from that as well.
but I mean, it's I think it's the same attitude when some people, when you receive a gift. What is the worst gift that you can receive? The worst gift is some people that gift you something that they think that you might like, and this kind of gift is not really a good gift. I think I really prefer the gift or the present when somebody gives you something that they like, because in this case you don't receive this gift, only this present, but you receive a point of view of something of somebody else. And this point of view is, I think, usually much more precious.
Yeah, definitely. Something that is meaningful to them, and then you get to keep a part of something that they deem as important.
That's more or less what I wanted to
Yeah.
say.
It kind of in a similar vein, are there any specific kind of artists or movements or experiences that have influenced your work, or are you working kind of completely independently in that sense?
And no, there is no void. I mean, we live, and so the whole context influences you in a. Sometimes you are conscious about it, and most of the times you are not. But I would say there are too many to cite, so I will not go down to this road to just drop out a few names. But I think the whole history of art, and especially also the whole history of graphic design, has shaped me in a way that I am now. So I guess these two fields in particular really shaped me.
Fantastic, thank you. And kind of, I think we have another maybe 5 minutes or so of the Twitter space left. So I wanted to kind of maybe ask you, having been in both the design and the art world for several years, is there any particular advice that you could give to people that are currently starting out?
In design or in art?
In one or the other, or maybe in both.
But one, it's very difficult. It's don't believe the hype. And the second is don't follow the fashion, which is basically the same thing.
That's amazing advice. I think that's definitely something that is very important. And kind of having a few more moments, could you tell us a little bit more about your upcoming projects, and something you're particularly excited about exploring in the near future? Where can our audiences follow you and find and discover your work in the next year?
Next year, I would say next week. So, as I mentioned before, there is a new collaboration going on between BA, Kim Asendorf and Leander. So, we are having our first show or exhibition. I don't know if I can use these words, but we have this thing, this event in Berlin at the 7th of December. And so, this is one step. And of course, this collaboration is in the very beginning. So, we already planned something happening next year, later in the summer, eventually. And so this is going on. And I have a lot of hardware pieces in the form of a prototype lying around in my studio. So some of my pieces I label with a one at the end. So there is LCD one. I can now say for the first time officially that there is LCD 2 coming. And
That's super exciting.
there is an older piece that had a hardware issue that never saw the light. But this issue has been resolved in the last month, in the last weeks, more or less. And so I hope that it will eventually see the light also next year. I have to think probably on a way to make it appealing to the crypto crowd. And yeah, there are a lot of projects lying around, finished or not unfinished, maybe a bit too many, and sometimes I feel a bit overwhelmed with all the things that are open. But I think this is a way of working. If all the projects are complete, if all the experiments are done, then I'm also done, and then I will simply shut up.
Well, I hope that they're continuously ongoing, and there's definitely some that are code based that I know will probably live for a very, very long time. Okay, so you can catch Andreas's show in the beginning of December in Berlin, and if any of you happen to be traveling to London, our gallery here is also hosting our very first Gazelli Lates. So a few of you who might have visited the gallery in the past might have collected something called a Gazelio Events Token or a GETS. And if you have, this is a little nudge, to remind you that you can actually claim your free ticket to the event on the 14th of December, our Gazelli Lates, for free. So if you do that before the 1st of December, then we can make sure that you're registered. So do come visit us in London as well, and do follow Andreas and follow Gazelio. And we hope to see you in the Web3 space very, very soon, and hopefully in real life as well. Thank you so much, Andreas. It was a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you.
Have a very lovely afternoon.
Bye bye.
See you soon. Bye. Bye.